We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is John Hathaway. He's Managing Director and Senior Portfolio Manager with Sprott Inc. and brings 50 years of investing experience to the table. How are you today, John?
Good, thank you.
John, we saw the attitude towards gold really shift around the Powell pivot. And you were speaking about this before in another interview. When the Fed basically changed from tightening their balance sheet to re-implementing QE infinity, what other macro factors play a role in propelling the price of gold higher right now?
The biggest one, and you hear some talk about it, but not enough, in my opinion, is very low interest rates. The reason that that's important is that bonds really cannot function as a portfolio risk mitigator the way they've done it traditionally. So traditional 60-40 configuration, 60% equities, 40% bonds, where if stocks were going to discount a recession, interest rates would decline and that would offset the decline in equities. So bonds would rise, equities would decline. That doesn't work anymore because basically bonds represent return-free risk. They're basically correlated 100% to equities. That really opens the door for gold, which has a proven history of mitigating risk. And you're beginning to see some large pension fund advisors think about allocating gold as a risk mitigator. And as long as rates stay in the 1%, 1.5% area, talking about the 10-year, something's got to replace bonds. And that something is most likely to be gold.
Excellent. I know you were talking about the sovereign negative yielding debt being a huge risk. Can you explain to us why this is such a big risk and when interest rates go up, what the consequences of that could be?
Well, if interest rates go up, which I don't think they will, certainly not by design, but if interest rates were to go up, you have a world economy that is heavily levered, both private and public sector. And the bankruptcy risk, the disruption to the economy from even a 50 basis point rise on interest rates across the yield curve would slow down the economy. It would create credit risks that are sort of beneath the surface. Very hard to imagine that anybody would like to see even a small rise in interest rates. And whatever we talked about in our previous conversation, it's only become worse. And the fragility of the system is even more than what we talked about in our previous conversation.
And I think one of the things that has really grown, extremely exacerbated the situation and added to that fragility is the U.S. debt to GDP ratio. So how have we seen that grow this year with the lockdowns? What are the effects of it? And are we going to see that continue to grow?
Well, I assume we're going to have a Biden administration, and I don't think there's any secret to the fact that he's all for more stimulus, another couple of trillion. There's no way that there's a market for it outside of what the Fed is going to do. The foreign buying has disappeared, private sector buying, maybe the banks will add to their position. But, you know, the supply of debt is just too great to be absorbed outside of the Federal Reserve. And therefore, debt to GDP seems to me we're now at 130-some%, could easily be 150 or 160% within the next couple of years.
What do these factors mean for the dollar going forward? We know that there's a couple of theories out there around the consequences of these policies. And I wanted to get your thoughts on which side of that. What camp do you fall into?
I fall into the camp that the dollar is very likely to decline from here. And that's always been friendly for gold. Frankly, I would say that dollar weakness is probably the strongest pillar in the argument for gold right now.
Excellent. John, on a Real Vision interview around a year ago, you made a call that the political environment was paving the way for a more radical, populist, left-leaning administration, which ended up being spot on. So what factors need to be taken into consideration if we end up with Biden as president?
To be honest, I mean, yeah, it's very constructive, although I never thought that Trump was much different. I mean, he was a populist. His policies were, you know, they're basically, it's Tweedledee and Tweedledum. I mean, but let's, you know, I assume we're going to have a Biden administration. There will be all kinds of spending initiatives. You know, if they're dumb enough to raise taxes, that's going to kill the economy. Certainly at the corporate level, we have to see whether that's going to actually transpire. But they're dumb enough to try to raise taxes. That'll only hurt the economy and widen the deficit picture we've just been talking about.
So if they do all kinds of infrastructure spending and stuff like that, that's the taxes are more important and weighting on the economy heavier than any type of stimulus they would provide like that?
Yeah. Deficit spending. Right now, it's been basically so-called stimulus, which is basically keeping the consumer alive. Yeah, if it's for infrastructure, whatever that means, I mean, who knows whether it's productive or not. But there will be a lot of money spent. And I guess if there's a silver lining in any of this, should there be a successful virus vaccine, that could create some optimism. It might give a jolt to the economy. But I don't know if that's enough to offset deficit spending that would take place to get the economy back pre-COVID levels. I would say it's a long shot that will be there within the next couple of years. Getting back to the size of the deficit, the reasons for the spending, I don't think it really makes much difference because we are in a period where the economy is underperforming. I think that'll last for at least another year. And if that's the case, you know, we're going to have huge deficits, a huge debt to GDP ratio, and ever greater fragility on the exposure to and even the small rise in interest rates.
John, with all these factors pointing towards the nuclear winter, as you called it, for gold being over, do we need any other fundamental tailwinds for gold to really start changing the psychology and attitudes towards it?
You know, we have plenty. We have so many things that are favorable. And I would say I'd come back to the big thing is that interest rates must remain low. Bonds can no longer do the job of offsetting equity risk. So large pools of capital will need to look elsewhere. And that one of the elsewhere that large pools of capital will look is gold. And then the other side of it is what we talked about earlier, which is a weaker dollar. The Fed doesn't want a strong dollar. Nobody wants a strong dollar, right? I'm just waiting to see further downside. There are many very elite investors who are calling for a 30% decline in the dollar from here. That would be dramatic. And if it did take place, that would be extremely bullish for gold. So yeah, to me, the two strong things are interest rates have to stay low. Our fiscal situation is we're basically in a position where we can't do anything about it and unlikely to do anything about it. And therefore, the dollar will weaken and gold will find its way into the institutional portfolios in a way that it hasn't historically.
You've said in the past that physical buying of metal doesn't necessarily drive the gold price. So why does the leveraged money need to start moving into this space to really make it move?
Well, I would say that it doesn't have to. I think that leverage money, hedge fund money, quant money, that kind of thing, that'll come and go. Again, I think if that's what you mean by leverage money. And that's really opportunity seeking capital. To me, the bigger story, you know, if you look at the fact that gold represents such a small percentage of $100 trillion of assets under management, I just went through this exercise. Let's assume that, in fact, I think it's a decent number for purposes of discussion, that there is $100 trillion of institutional money under management of all kinds. That would be pension funds, that would be mutual funds, it would be private wealth, all categories, sovereign wealth. So if 1% were to move into gold over the next couple of years, that would be 1 trillion. 1 trillion of demand for gold would be about 6 years of new mine supply. That's how under-owned gold is. And in my mind, there's no way that you could clear the market at current prices if 1 trillion were to move into physical metal. So it doesn't take leverage. It just takes the reality of low interest rates. Capital needs a place to go to protect equity risk. and gold is going to fill that vacuum. And using that math, you could easily see gold at 5 times the current price.
Excellent, John. I'd like to move a little bit to mining stocks. And we've seen them be so out of favor for the last several years. And I'd like you to explain to maybe some of the listeners that don't necessarily understand the dynamic of how a relatively marginal rise in gold prices can massively affect the gold miners' value and how their profit margins can go up exponentially, like I said, with a small move in the gold price.
Well, just the basic math there is it costs $1,000 an ounce to produce an ounce of gold. It's pretty much the global number. And if the gold price averages, which it did, I guess, last year, something like $1,500 to $1,600. So that means the profit margin on producing an ounce of gold was, let's call it $500. This year, the average price of gold, going to guess, because the year isn't over, but let's say it's $1,800. That's a 60% increase in the profit margin of producing an ounce of gold for the industry worldwide. And you've seen numbers that are just staggering in terms of profitability. These companies report their third quarter results. There has been a positive reaction, but to me, the stocks are still ridiculously inexpensive. Free cash flow yields for many of the larger companies like Newmont, Barrick, Agnico are, let's call them, mid to high single digits. And there are many other mid-cap to smaller companies that are producing gold that generate free cash flow yield. So that's free cash flow over a denominator of enterprise value of 20%. That is, you know, unless you don't think the gold price can stay here, which I would dispute, I think it will, and move higher. That's an incredibly positive valuation prospect for mining stocks. And what we're seeing are dividend increases right across the board. We're seeing debt pay downs so that this industry is no longer financially leveraged. I think it's in very, very good condition financially. And they're piling up cash even with all of this. So the outlook is for cash generation, dividend increases, and strong year-over-year earnings comparison. So, I mean, you couldn't write a better scenario for an equity thesis than what gold has right now.
As we're speaking about the finances of these companies, have we seen capital become much easier to get for these companies? And how has it changed things in this space? Like, are we starting to see companies that don't necessarily deserve capital starting to pop up yet?
Well, actually, they don't need capital. I mean, they're generating so much by themselves that you're not seeing a shortage of capital. I mean, I'm sure investment banking industry would love to do a bunch of deals, but the industry doesn't need the capital. So I would say we're in a very different place than we may have been 10 years ago.
John, what are some of the most leveraged ways, in your opinion, to speculate in this space? Would you favor M&A targets close to the top of that list?
Well, there have been a lot of takeovers, but a lot of them have been like mergers of equals. So not a huge premium. I can think of 3 or 4 in the last 3 months or so that were, you know, closer to being mergers of equals. So not a lot of deal related upside. That could change, but right now I don't see that taking place. The best leverage is if you buy a large cap company like Newmont or Barrick, and, you know, they continue to crank out all this cash flow, that's plenty of leverage because the stocks are still so undervalued. You don't have to hypothesize a big increase in free cash flow yields from, say, 8 or 9% down to 2 or 3% to get easily doubles and triples in many mining stocks. And if you want to be more leveraged, you can go down the pecking order to mid and smaller cap stocks that are discounted for various reasons. But still, if you have a company that's trading at 18, 20% free cash flow yield and it goes to 10%, that's a double and it's still cheap. So I don't think you need to stretch too much these days. I think you just buy quality stocks. You don't have to buy a lot of the junior names that are, which we own them and we like them, but they don't produce cash, at least yet. They will in many cases. but they're riskier just because they don't produce cash. To me, if I were to allocate money to the space, I would own large cap stocks and a good array, good selection of mid to smaller cap companies that are actually producing.
So, John, when you're talking about how you're valuing those larger cap stocks, what kind of metrics are you using to really try and understand how they're undervalued at this time?
It comes down to what I've been talking about, cash generation, free cash flow yields. The companies can't spend the money they're generating. It's a great situation to be in. I mean, I could give you other things. You could look at price to net asset value. You could look at price earnings ratios, you know, very traditional things, price to cash flow, enterprise value to EBITDA. I mean, one thing that we talked about recently is that enterprise value to EBITDA for the industry generally is around 8 times, which is not bad. But compare that to the S&P, it's about 18 times. So again, you could just look at a very simple metric like enterprise value to EBITDA, and the gold mining group is half as expensive as the standard variety component of the S&P.
Perfect. When we're looking at the smaller and mid-tier companies, I'd like to get your thoughts about a single asset company and the reasons the market might possibly discount those.
Okay. Well, I mean, typically that's because those companies would be located in jurisdictions that where there's a lot of headline risk. You know, if you take a company, I'll give you a name just as an example. If you take something like Torex, which we like and own a lot of, they're located in Mexico, and they're located in a part of Mexico that's had, let's say, some issues, social license issues. And that, I mean, Torex does a great job of this, but they're still hurt by the headline risk of being located there. If Torex were part of a larger company like Newmont or Agnico Eagle, that headline risk would go away. So in my mind, the single asset discount, which is real, and it's not just for Mexico. You could talk about companies that are located in Canada. Another name that comes to mind is Pretium Resources. There's always a magnification of every little glitch for a single asset company that you don't get with an Agnico or a Newcrest or a Barrick or a Newmont.
John, are there any other assets that you're looking at, let's say besides gold and silver, that make for a very asymmetrical bet right now?
No, not the answer is no. I'd like to sound more open-minded about it, but to me, the setup for gold is so incredible. It's the best I've seen it in my 20 plus years of doing it. And if you think that the thesis on gold is correct and that the price moves higher over the next 3 to 5 years without the world coming to an end, but just because interest rates can't go up, the dollar is going to weaken. You don't have to talk about inflation or, you know, end of the world stuff. And if you believe that, then I can't think of another time in my following the gold space when the setup has been as compelling as it is right now for owning gold mining equities.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing to be focused on one thing. One of the other things I'd like to get your thoughts on, John, I know in another interview you were sharing that you don't think that Bitcoin is a threat to gold. Can you share with us a little bit more about that, please?
People who like Bitcoin, people like gold, they're coming from the same place. They don't trust central banking. They don't trust paper currency. And so I just feel like it's like a losing proposition to get into a battle with people who like Bitcoin and saying, well, gee, gold is better, or for them to say Bitcoin is better than gold. I mean, I just don't see the point of chasing your tail about that. I think they both have merit. And, you know, I saw where Stan Druckenmiller just came out and gave a thumbs up to Bitcoin. So I can see Bitcoin doing really well. Not for everybody. It's more for people who are sort of the millennials, tech-oriented, Silicon Valley, all of that. But it's not going to displace gold. It's much smaller. Gold has got a, you know, 4,000-year history of protecting capital. Bitcoin is new. It may also protect capital. has a lot to recommend it. But again, I just shy away from getting too caught up in gold versus Bitcoin.
Is there anything that I haven't, or that we haven't touched on, that you think is very important for our audience of, let's say, gold investors, gold bugs, to understand?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, to me, gold is so underowned. It's still hated. It's not mainstream. You're fighting City Hall. Nobody really wants to get on board with it. It's career risk for somebody in a straightforward investment firm. So it's a fringe investment strategy. And, you know, I think from time to time, it's going to get, you know, it's going to get knocked down a peg or two, like we saw recently with the announcement that Pfizer's come up with a vaccine, which is great. I mean, you know, who doesn't want a vaccine? And so people, you know, the quants just jumped all over it because it's a pair trade. Time will tell. But to me, the possibility of a vaccine does not change anything of what we've talked about in terms of low interest rates, negative interest rates, a weaker dollar, fiscal picture being dire for the U.S. and other Western democracies. But just remember that gold is, you know, for a long time has been considered to be a fringe strategy that is in some ways unfriendly to the orthodox thinking of mainstream investors. And in a way, for those of us who are supportive of gold, you're going to be fighting City Hall all the way from $1,800 to $5,000. And, you know, I don't mind doing that. I've been doing it for a long time. But just remember that you don't have a lot of agreement from the consensus on the opportunity that gold represents.
Excellent. So in doing some research for today's discussion with you, John, I came across you saying something about basically identifying your time and your ability to still write your newsletter relative to where we are in the gold market. So are you still able to write it, or are you too busy to be able to do it right now?
No, I'm never too busy to spout off. So, no, I mean, I still do it. I try to write 4 times a year, maybe more if necessary. A lot of the job is basically trying to explain it, convey the investment rationale. And, you know, there are others who do it very well, but I think it just goes with the turf. You have to explain yourself all the time because gold is such an out-of-favor investment idea.
And is there somewhere that our listeners can be able to read that?
Sure. All you have to do is go to the Sprott website. There's everything I've ever said is archived there.
Perfect. Is there anything else you'd like to mention as we wrap up here, John?
Boy, I think we've covered an awful lot of territory. Feels like I've been drained of any potential additional information. So no, I think you've done a great job kind of covering all the key points.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate your time today, John, and look forward to reading your newsletter. Thank you very much.
Okay, Tom. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.